Aetna has over 1.6 million care providers. So whether you need a urologist, dermatologist, or otolaryngologist, our team's got you covered. Because healthier happens together. For all your healthcare moments, choose Aetna. Learn more at aetna.com/moments.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hello, everyone. I'm Danny Pellegrino.
I'm Jenna Brister.
And we are back for season four of a very, very iconic podcast, where the two of us recap all the holiday movies we love and some that we don't love so much.
Yes, thank you so much for tuning in. Tis the season.
That's right. We're covering some classics this year. We are recapping the entire Santa Claus trilogy. We're going to be diving into a Halloween movie this year.
Yes, Hocus Pocus 2.
That's right, the sequel. We also have I'll Be Home for Christmas starring Jonathan Taylor Thomas. So we are leaning into the home improvement of it all. And if you want to follow along, you can go to Instagram. It's at A Very Merry Iconic Podcast on Instagram. And be sure to listen, subscribe, tell a friend.
Have a very merry, iconic day.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hey, everybody. To celebrate our 300th episode, we're doing a live podcast at the Knitting Factory in Brooklyn on March 16th. We've got Blake Schwarzenbach from Jawbreaker, Brian Baker, Minor Threat and Bad Religion, and Laura Stevenson. It's going to be awesome. If you want to get tickets, you can find links at our website, goingofftrack.com.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to Going Off Track.
Hey, Jonah.
Hey, Brad.
Hello.
Steven. Hello, Benny.
Hello.
The whole gang's here except for Steven Smith, who's sick.
Yes, no, Steven? His children are sick.
Children are sick.
Which probably means he's sick. Right?
He offered to send germs. He will be. He's not now. He will be.
Kind of eventually. How it goes.
So if you have kids and they get sick, what are the odds you're going to get sick?
Like 80 to 90%?
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Yeah. I mean, because it's not like you can quarantine yourself from your own sick children. Like, you have to tend to them.
Right.
You can put it off, like, but, I mean, like, I remember when I had, like, my daughter was sick, and then my son got sick, and I felt like, okay, I'm going to get through this, because, like, it had been, like, a week, and I was feeling good. And then there was that one moment I'm on the couch, and he sneezed right into my mouth.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's the moment.
Well, that's the kicker. It's not just the illness. It's that they're completely disrespectful and not courteous. They don't understand any boundaries of, like, hygiene and personal space. They're fucking disgusting. So
sounds like the New York City subway, huh?
Oh, a little topical humor.
Yeah. So, how about this interview, huh?
Speaking of sick.
Woo!
How about this interview today? Today marked the return of Andrew WK.
Yeah. I'd say triumphant return.
The triumphant return.
Absolutely.
Andrew WK has an album coming out on March 2nd called You're Not Alone. I just released a song called Music is Worth Living For. And what did you guys think of this interview? I thought it was super awesome.
Oh my God. I think we went on like a journey.
Yes.
Through space.
Yes.
And then I think we covered some things that aren't always covered with Andrew WK.
I agree.
His outfits.
If you've ever wondered
how... I'm glad
how,
you guys talked about that. Yeah. I wasn't here.
How he got those shirts so perfectly dirty.
Yeah. It's like,
Benny,
they
that
don't...
That was all you.
Yeah. I mean,
they
don't,
it was
that was all
I'm
you,
saying,
Benny.
They don't come yellow.
They don't come yellow. We find out how to turn them yellow.
Yeah.
We find out how to deal with road rage and the universe.
I mean, I really appreciated that.
It goes all over the place.
So he's an interesting man. He toes the line, right?
Yes.
You don't really know what he's all about.
No.
He doesn't tip his cap. He plays the center of the universe.
He does.
And I kind of dig it.
Yeah. I don't know if we know him more or less. But nonetheless, very, very interesting interview. Thanks to Andrew WK for coming by. So let's listen to this episode with him now.
I think anything that they can ever connect the possibility of ever contributing to anything that in turn could contribute to the possibility of someday getting cancer, they put this warning on.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because there's so many other hazards.
A million.
That would be more likely to be harmed.
You should put it on a Big Mac in that case.
Well, I think they probably are working on that. Yeah. I'm sure they've been
trying to do
that.
Someone's probably working on that.
But I mean, you know, why not have warning labels about everything else crossing the street? You know, it's raining outside, don't go driving. And I guess they kind of do, but they're the only place that takes it to that level. It's obviously a point of pride.
Yeah.
And I suppose they see it as a responsibility. When you're getting on airplanes, on the outside, right, by the boarding, down the jetway.
Yeah.
When you're crossing that threshold, where the plane will put maybe like the awards they've won and things like that, there'll also be one up over there that the state of California has found that materials used in this plane have been shown to contribute to cancer. So they've even got it on the planes.
Wow. And that's just because that plane may go to California at some point.
Or someone from California might fly on
it. This is one thing I've always wondered is, I mean, I'm sure you've been on flights, thousands of flights, hundreds maybe at this point. I don't know what your numbers are.
That's a good question. I don't know.
I have some theories, but why are there still ashtrays built into brand new airplanes?
They are? Brand new ones.
Really?
And the only answer I can come up with is that this is a long-term plan for the aftermarket of this plane. Like 20 years from now, we're going to sell this to a country that you can smoke on flights. This is my only guess.
I actually think that they reuse parts in building new planes.
Is that
right? A lot of them are just refabricated parts.
Repurposed plane parts?
Definitely.
See, how do you have to put a sticker on a plane that it'll give you cancer, but you don't have to put a sticker on saying, we built this plane with aftermarket plane parts?
I'm sure it's somewhere in the fine print when you buy your ticket.
I would love that one.
You hit accept. That no one reads.
Really?
I'm sure.
Aftermarket plane parts?
Something in the legal, I'm sure.
We admire their resourcefulness when it comes to reusing anything. I mean, it's better to have it go back into a plane, I guess, in theory, than in a heap.
That's true.
They can reclaim it. And if it is something relatively harmless, like an armrest, I'd rather they reuse an armrest than an engine, I suppose, or some flap on the wing. I remember being particularly fascinated as a child. This is one of my rare childhood memories, and it could have been around the age of 4 or 5, sitting in a seat where the armrest had one of the ashtrays that popped out in that really satisfying way, that brushed steel.
Totally.
And just that enough give and enough smoothness that it was somewhat challenging to pull out and then very satisfying to push in.
Yes.
And I think I opened it and closed it until the man sitting in the row next to my mom and me asked her to ask me to please stop.
It's funny you mention that because I have in my head,
exactly what you're talking about.
You definitely just sparked a childhood memory of extremely satisfying experiences with those ashtrays.
Like some really hard gum.
Yeah, crusty gum. And there's the flip top ones too. There's the ones that open like frit.
And then,
and then there's ones that you push
the
one side.
Trap door almost.
Yes. Yeah, the trap door.
And some even had the little S coil in there to rest the cigarette.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Yes. Remember you could smoke in malls? Like, you just walk, you know?
I do remember that. And it mingled with the smells of the food court.
Yeah.
And I remember when people smoked on planes, and it was really intense. Because it was always in the back.
Like going to Europe, people smoked on planes. When I was, when I was young, you could still,
in the back or anywhere?
I think anywhere. Oh, wow. International. I was really young.
Yeah.
But,
I mean, the smoke, it doesn't matter if it's in the back.
Same thing about no smoking at, like, Denny's. Like, you set the table next to them.
Right.
Yeah.
The non-smoking section is how many feet away?
Yeah, they didn't really work out.
I was just in Japan, and people smoke inside everywhere.
Like, yeah, that's still going there. But like, that's been in the works of, they've been attempting to dismantle that for a while. And the first step, I guess, as it happened here, kind of, is now certain businesses have taken the lead where they no longer allow their employees to smoke in the office.
Right. We were in one office building that it was clearly no smoking signs everywhere. But restaurants, people just eating, smoking right next to you.
I remember the big to-do around here when they finally took the smoking out of bars in New York. I mean, that was like people went crazy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It was interesting. At first, I felt, and I didn't smoke.
Were you in New York at that time? Probably were, right?
And I felt somehow disappointed, though I didn't even go to bars that much at that time. But then I remembered how nice it was to finally get home and not smell like the bar or like the cigarettes.
Right. Yeah.
And that was the only plus side. Otherwise, I think I kind of liked, I guess, maybe the decadence of it or what the smokiness. I mean, smoke is appealing in its own way, just like a campfire or that a birthday candle going out or incense, there's something interesting and misty about it, right? It makes the atmosphere look different.
That's true.
And the smells, if you're having fun and you associate that fun stuff with all the surrounding elements and the sensory experience, then all of a sudden the smoke is fun and you feel like people are taking part of your fun away, even if you don't smoke. But I think it is probably for the best now.
But makes as movies. A singer, did that ever mess with you?
I don't know. Maybe. I never really smoked that heavy just tobacco. I mean, I guess at times I did. And yeah, I mean.
Or even being in like a club somewhere where people just. Because I remember like seeing shows.
Yeah, it makes your throat burn and your eyes sting and stuff like that.
Anti-Flag would play and they'd be like, no smoking.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
people would be like.
Oh, in the venue.
In the venue. And people are like losing their minds.
Yeah.
That's a bit bold. But I have noticed recently, even at outdoor festivals, where someone would be smoking on the side of the stage or something like that. I couldn't see, but you could smell it, and it had an affecting quality. I wouldn't dare tell them to not do it. But I thought, wow, now I remember how this used to be when there was a lot of smoke, and it was, I guess, a bit unpleasant.
Yeah.
I feel like in some ways now, it's like, at least here on the East Coast, it's so taboo to smoke now. That even at an outdoor festival, if you see someone smoking, it's shocking.
Yeah. Like, that person is like a cowboy now.
Totally.
Yeah. The Joe Camel Marlboro thing, proper work. The guy who's smoking at a festival now might as well be wearing like chaps and a cowboy hat. They're like a real Buffalo soldier out there.
That's true.
It does stand out as an interesting, as something remarkable. It's like, huh.
But is it nostalgia or is us falling for the marketing ploys of many, many years just
maybe all those things combined? I mean, my dad smoked still. I think he still does. I mean, I basically would say that he still does smoke. And so I have a lot of connections to that smell, the way his office smelled, his clothes smelled, his car smelled. Yeah. Oh, his car.
Yeah.
And my first car was his old car.
Right.
That had been in storage for a long time.
You can't get that smell out.
And you could. And no. I didn't want to. And I let my friends all smoke in the car so that it would keep having that smell I associate with my dad. And then you do wonder, well, is this all some part of a manipulation? And I think that we can observe all those facets to it and not need to make a judgment about it definitively. And you can still say, but I don't want to smoke.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I've given up on trying to tell my dad to not smoke or things like that. I have another friend who's actually sort of similar age range. An older gentleman who told me, he said, some people were just meant to smoke. I thought, wow, I never thought about it like that. Like it was his destiny.
Yeah.
And to not do it would be disrespectful to his path in life.
Wow.
So I said, hey, you know what? It'd be like someone telling me to cut my hair. Don't play piano or something.
Since not long after the invention of fire, people have been smoking any manner of things, right? Yeah. I mean, it is kind of inherent.
The first thing they did,
right?
Once they lit something, they said, let's put that in our mouth.
Yeah.
And suck.
I mean, I can't for the life of me, I wish, like, I'm not really into time travel or anything like that. I don't have that big of an interest in going back, and I'd be afraid of like ripping a weed out of the ground and Ray Bradbury thing will happen and all of a sudden we're dead. But I do really wonder who was just the first person who figured that out with weed.
To smoke.
Just like, who's the first person
who
threw that into a campfire and it's just like, oh, hell yeah. You know, I don't know.
I was just talking about this today, oddly enough.
I mean, where was it growing? I guess we could maybe we could at least give it a geographic term of like where it was even possible, right?
I think it grows all over the place.
Even in super cold? I think it needs to be
maybe
moist.
Not super cold.
I don't
know. It's quite robust, right?
It's a weed. That's part of the beauty.
Yeah.
It's resilient and it's not very picky. It seems, but there must have been some person, in a tribe, whose job was to test out all that they had access to, every plant, every fruit.
I feel like it's indigenous to the Americas.
Is that possible?
I don't know.
I mean, like hemp production was.
I mean, you
hemp
know,
was used for.
It's true.
For year, like. I don't know how long.
Could be, right?
It could be. I mean, people at Terrace McKenna have like these stoned ape theories about apes eating mushrooms, psychedelics, and then inventing fire and sort of.
Well, that's what gave them those like breakthroughs.
Exactly. So that could be.
I was going to talk about like the burning bush theory.
Yeah.
That it was like a psychedelic trip.
Yeah.
Actually.
There's a lot of stuff like that.
Andrew, that makes sense.
You mentioned destiny about smoking, but it's also something that kind of comes up. This is like my version of a segue.
That's
quite, it's quite bold.
Good. Thank you.
Smooth.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well done. You're really getting good at this. How many episodes in are we in?
Almost 300 in. Yeah, and I like to do segues and then point out I'm doing it as I'm doing it and then come back to it.
I'd like to note that it was about episode 275 that Jonas started coming in with notes.
Yeah, this is this is a recent thing, but I wanted to prepare for
onward
this
and upward. Hey, progress is progress.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, there is some... Do you believe in kind of the idea of destiny? Because I know in the record you talk about kind of making your dreams your destiny.
When it comes to beliefs in general, and I'll try not to get too vast here to keep it flowing, but it's almost going back to what we said about having all these different views on something like smoking without having to necessarily settle on one definitively. So I have views on things like destiny.
Sure.
And I think personally, the best way I've been able to interpret experiences that have been hard for me to explain otherwise is to attribute them to this concept of destiny. Do I believe in it? Well, if someone said they didn't believe in it and they haven't had experiences like that, I wouldn't say, well, they're wrong. I would say, okay. But I think it's a way we have concepts that we can apply to mysterious parts of life that help to maybe not make them less mysterious, but to help us embrace them differently in a positive way. So what might be confusing and perplexing and maybe where you feel like you're not in control, you say, oh, well, it's just destiny. And then you've turned yourself over to this sense of a path or a purpose that might not be rational. It might not have to do with what you want to do, but what you're meant to do, what
almost
you were born
predetermination.
To do. Yeah. So yeah. I have seen a lot in my own experiences that seem to point towards that.
Hmm.
So I guess I live as though that's what's going on for me.
I mean, now that being said, like, do you only like fall on that concept of destiny, like when you need it, you know, like when you're like,
it's convenient.
Well, no, kind of like the idea that like, shit, like this happened. I can't explain it. This sucks. Maybe like destiny is a good way for me to like internalize.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's when it's most helpful.
Sure.
Yeah. Cause if you feel like you're putting one foot in front of the other and carrying out a plan that you devised, you don't need something like destiny because you can take credit for yourself. But when right. something goes bad and didn't go as you planned, right. you think, oh, well, it's destiny. It's a way of finding comfort, for sure. Or, again, of turning yourself over to your own life and maybe looking at it as a test, as an ordeal, as a challenge that you're supposed to learn from and triumph through. Not necessarily triumph over, even, but to somehow develop some new attribute, even if it's something as simple yet challenging as patience or kindness or being able to not get your way and be okay with it. So all of it I try to think of as there's a point to all of it.
Mm.
And again, there may not be.
Right.
You know? And I think it's okay to question that too. But if I have to settle on one mindset as an operational mindset, I settle on the point, the purpose, the meaning, the destiny, the quest, all those things, because it's more interesting for me.
Where do you find in that, like, some, because, you know, I feel like I almost operate in the same way, where it's like you're left with certain choices in life and you need to operate in the best way you can and find the best way you can to move through it, but that only leaves you so much from like the functional side of things. Like, where does that leave you on like an emotional side of things? Or like, you know, you can make like an actual, like, I'm going to do this and no matter what, I'm going to figure out a way to do it. But that's like a tangibly physical thing you can do. It's black and white. Like, where do you find the answers for like the gray area? Like the things that you just can't pinpoint like that.
Sometimes you just let them float there.
Yeah,
and you don't get to put them in a this, that, or the other
right.
spot.
Don't even try to manage or control them.
I think you can engage with it, but you don't ever get it. It never will settle anywhere. So there will be whole parts of life that will remain confusing.
Right.
And to be able to accept them as perpetually confusing, I think, is an important developmental step.
Sure.
Because it's quite stressful and it's not pleasant. There's a maybe... Early on in life where everything seems quite strange and amazing and overwhelming. our instinct is to start locking things down so we can make sense of things and figuring out how to navigate in a very basic day-to-day sense, including physically, as you're saying, I want to do this, so I'm going to do this.
Right.
And when things don't work out that way, we get frustrated and angry because sure. we wanted to do this. Why isn't it happening? And then we maybe a bit older start to dismantle some of those assumptions and some of those opinions and beliefs and some of that structure and question it. And we can even blow it all apart. And then maybe after it's all blown apart, you realize there was a reason that some of it held together better when it was assembled. So you reassemble it, but maybe with more understanding or appreciation. Mm. I think it's half and half to some degree. You're trying to, in a weird sense, limit your emotion, I think, so that it doesn't freak you out.
Right.
So that you have some kind of rational stability in sure. your life and are not overwhelmed by your inner feelings. But you're also trying to get some kind of control on the rationality so that it can be there to serve the emotions.
Right.
Yeah. To carry out, the mind wants to carry out the mind wants to be in charge of everything. Then the heart is quite gentle. Mm. But if you can somehow, I think, you try to carve out a space for the mind to do the will of the heart, right? To do that work. And that's just trusting this very deep instinct that's so deep it doesn't even feel like it's coming from you.
Right.
And that can be, again, why it feels like destiny. Because, I used to think what it was to have a dream was that you figured out what you most enjoyed and you set goals and had sort of imagination-based fantasies about what you wanted to carry out, and you put your body into action, you pushed towards that dream, and you pushed and you pushed and you made what you wanted to do.
Yeah.
But now it seems from my experience that it's your dream dreams you, and it pulls you towards it if you allow it to,
if you don't
fight.
So do you think that determination, what you're talking about, is when, like, the mind overpowers the heart? Like you said, like, the heart is gentle, and if you don't reel it back, the mind will just steamroll the heart.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
is that like kind of a
definitely. Yeah. Why did I want to move here when I was 18? This is one of the more difficult places I could have moved at any time, but especially at that age.
I heard that Alicia Keys song.
There you go. She was from here though, too.
Yeah, she's from here.
But she's telling us, like, be warned, I'm from here.
Yeah, still she's intense. Like, she's giving you a flag, yeah.
But I wanted to go here and I couldn't really explain it.
Right.
I mean, I had, at that time especially, made up a lot of what seemed like very legitimate reasons. But deep down inside, I had a lot of doubts. And a lot of people told me I was crazy, it was a bad decision, and it would be a horrible mistake. But I still felt compelled to do it. And if I had listened too much to my mind, my rational, it was an irrational thing to do.
Yeah.
But I did it anyway. And then even the reasons I moved here for all disintegrated instantly, which was another challenge. And I realized, wow, that was just to get me here. And now I'm supposed to be here for something else to happen.
So what was that? What was, like, the impetus that got you to New York and fell apart quickly?
Well, the point was just to come to New York because it felt like that's where things were supposed to happen. Like, where there was never, for as long as I could remember, if I was going to move anywhere, that's where you go.
Sure.
That just seemed like what you did. What it's sort of, there were these assumptions. For example, if you play music, you play it as intensely as you can. If you make a painting, you make it as, I guess it was the most intense place,
right.
I was drawn to that intensity feeling. So, no, initially I was going to go to school or I was very interested in being a fashion designer, actually. And I set up, it's a bit of a long story, but to make it short, I got hired at a company called Comme des Garçons. When they used to be in Soho, and that was my first job. I moved here with that job already. I'd written them letters when I was 15.
Okay.
They said, okay, well, if you're really serious and you want to work here when you're 18, contact us again.
Cool.
And so I waited 3 years, which seemed like an eternity, and came out here, and after 2 months, I was fired and cried, and it was a disaster. And I thought, what am I doing? But I managed to stay, and that's when this other feeling started pulling. I never wanted to be a musician. I played piano since I was a little kid and always did music, but it was so second nature. And I don't mean in terms of my skill level, but it was such an inseparable part of life that it wasn't even what I considered an interest or a hobby or a passion. It was something you did. Like, once you learn how to read, you just learn how to read. It doesn't occur to you to be a professional reader or something like that.
Right,
was piano your first instrument?
Yeah, that was my first whole musical encounter. I'd never really heard much music even before that. My dad played piano and was taking lessons himself when I was born. So that was the first music that I was exposed to, and him taking lessons and seeing his piano teacher and then me taking lessons around four. That was the first time I'd seen anyone else play music, and to see adults that played music as a living and realize that music can make you feel this certain way that nothing else could, and that it wasn't a fluke.
Yeah.
I remember very clearly watching one of my piano teachers play this piece that she was working on, because she was actually a graduate student who taught kids as part of her education. And she played this piece, and I got these waves. It was really like an orgasm, but I didn't know that at the time, being 5 years old, 6 years old. These waves of physical sensation.
Cool.
Like tingling chills up your butterflies in your stomach and the spine going crazy. And I just thought it was some weird thing. It was actually a little bit unnerving.
Sure.
Not sure if you wanted to feel it again. And then I realized that it kept happening in the certain part of the melody. And that's what music could do.
Huh. Do you still get that feeling?
If I do the things properly, yeah.
I feel like that's like the piece the feeling is good. You like try to.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying
it's
to
like
get
tapping
at.
Into that.
Harder to find,
that
right?
That is the goal of all music, as far as I'm concerned, and certainly what I'm trying to do using my particular approach to it.
Yeah.
I mean, you sort of say it's kind of talking about the new record, sort of, especially the song that came out today, "Music Is Worth Living For." Kind of listening to music can make you a better person. And I'm sort of a little curious, do you ever get kind of, like, what keeps you kind of positive about this stuff? I mean, do you ever get jaded by, like, the business aspects or all these other aspects of it that don't involve playing music but you sort of have to deal with daily? Like, how do you push through that?
There's been frustrations, not specifically because of the business. I actually really like that side of it because I feel like it's something you have control over. So much of the musical phenomenon is so mysterious. And there's this X factor called other people where it doesn't matter how what you do, once you put it out there, who doesn't matter.
Sure.
They could like it. It's the strangest thing, because you can build a house and you know that this is a great house, and you see what you build, and someone can walk in and say this it's standing up, the door is open and closed properly, this is a functioning house. You build this song, someone might hear and go, I don't know, this isn't working at all. But that's a great possibility, because someone else might say this is the greatest song I've ever heard, and that's what keeps you hooked in this. It's like gambling, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
You might, this next one might just be the thing that connects with those other people. I liked the business side of it from the very beginning, and I guess was warned again, and maybe by part of my own mindset, by many people, to watch out for that and stay away, and it's these people are evil, and don't get close to the people you work with. And I just went against that and followed this other instinct that this is all part of it. And I enjoy that in many ways just as much as I love the whole thing. I'm very fortunate. I feel lucky. I don't think that always happens. And for those that don't enjoy all of it, I have sympathy for them. I'm fortunate that I like every part of it, from laying out the artwork to laying out the tour to laying out the show to being on tour to doing what we're doing right now, because I feel like it's my purpose. So it's all a chance for me to serve this feeling in one way or another, and it all counts. So even going into a meeting is me representing this sensation I'm trying to manifest with people that are there for one reason or another to help that happen, even if it's just for money or that's their day job or whatever it is. Here's the chance I have. It's not about me. It's about this feeling. And can we use the resources that we have to maximize it?
How do you find it's been the best way to, like, you know, walk into, like, you know, one of those, a label thing or something like that, where there's this person works for this thing and this and this and this, and you're looking at like 10 people, and like you said, their intentions, you know, they're all going to tell you the same thing, but their intentions could be quite, you know, quite different. How do you find like walking into a place like that and really getting people to get like invested in your music, like not just working on it? Like, I know that's a tricky thing when people are speaking for you, especially.
You just hope that the party gods bring the right people into your sphere.
Yeah.
And I've, again, been very, very lucky to... I would have been lucky just to have one great person. And I've had probably a dozen at this point. Like, phenomenal one in a billion people that would... They have loyalty and a work ethic that inspires me, mm-hmm. and do what they do because it's how they live, which in a way is even more inspiring and admirable. It's not just the way they do what they do for me. It's the way they do what they do for everything they do in life. Yeah. And you just hope to find those people. And when you do find one, you do everything you possibly can to keep them, to give them recognition and to thank them. But you also accept that there will be people who just don't get it. And I don't mean, and they could even be right. And that's where it gets puzzling, because think that the guy doesn't like it. Well, maybe he's onto something. right. You just, for those that are meant to be part of it, they will. And you just hope that you find them sooner than later.
Mm. Definitely. I mean, and that sort of feeds into this idea on the record, kind of this duality of kind of, I don't know, light or dark or good and evil. And I think you have a really interesting perspective, sort of, that like the darkness, you know, the light illuminates the darkness. They can't exist without each other. I mean, how did you kind of like, how does that ideology kind of play into your life? And because I feel like the darkness can be overwhelming for so many people.
Well, it's an age old concept.
Yes.
And it's one of the oldest, maybe even the oldest theme to work on. Yeah. But that's because it seems to explain so much and resonate with so many experiences in life on very minute, almost inconsequential scales, and then on very intense, painful and dramatic scales. I think the basic way that I started recognizing or relating to that concept of light and dark being a harmony rather than a dissonance was that I was motivated to start doing this because I felt bad. Mm-hmm. And if I had felt good all along from the start, I mean, I was just by default of a kind of negative person and, sure. and coming from that spectrum, but really wanted to feel a different way. And that's when I found that music and working on this kind of stuff made me feel differently. Didn't just make me feel better. It made me feel like a different version of myself that was better. So you could imagine what would it feel like, be like to be me, but be really great, or to feel really great. And this work or this mission put me in direct contact with that effort and gave me a reason to do that effort. It wasn't just to cheer myself up for the sake of it. It was to cheer myself up by making something that maybe mm-hmm. someone else would, to just amplify the light. But there would have been no reason to amplify the light if I hadn't been awash in shadow.
Right.
And so then I'm very thankful in a strange and almost perverse way for that shadow. And this is sure. the thing that you can get caught up in, where you don't want to lose that painful side, because that's where so much of the inspiration has come from. But
and then some people may even create that pain, right?
To be self-inflicted.
Able to create, yeah.
I've had experience with that as well, and it's not something I'm proud of at all. But I have learned from it. It's humbling and enlightening. Ultimately, I don't think anyone has to go through that, and you shouldn't seek out to do it. Most times, it just seems to happen on its own, even if it's by your own choosing. I don't think you say, okay, well, actually, I don't think you say, I'm going to be a horrible person. But there were times when I almost was thinking that way. I gave up, in a sense. I just can't.
Just to push yourself to a different extreme, or just because you had given up on
just
people
poor,
at that point?
Poor moral character and succumbing to that. But you try to then transform that into something worthy of human life. And that's the alchemical process. You know, you're making lead into gold. You're making something base and even poisonous into something like the life force elixir.
Do you think that that's inherent, or do you think that it's learned, like nature, you know, nurture versus nature? Like,
I think it's inherent, and then the awareness of it is learned.
Mm. Yeah.
So I think most of these things we're all going through, and that's why these archetypal stories and concepts and myths, they make sense and they resonate on many levels. Sure. They resonate even if you don't know that they're resonating. So you can like a movie like, I don't know, a lot of Disney cartoons. And when I was so young, I didn't know any of these things, but there was something very deep that I obviously grasped without even realizing that it was already in me. And that is a bit of a mystery. I don't think they still really figure out where that's emerging from.
Right.
I think some of it you are born with.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because then things like Disney and even someone like Mr. Rogers or something have not admitted like it's some scam, but their purpose was understanding the psychology of a child and catering to things that would serve that child. So, I mean, like you said, just to even have that knowledge, there would be an inherent set of things and people that you need to address that are just always there.
Yeah, and what better way to do it than with a cartoon like Pinocchio, something very appealing and instantaneous and approachable. And to be honest, that's one of the reasons why I've really liked working in this style that I've wound up working in, is because it's approachable and inviting, and it's engaging and it's easy. Mm-hmm. But you can go in there. I mean, it's a lofty goal, and I'm not saying I pulled it off, but you want to be able to create something very palatable that then within it has the space to explore the human experience.
When you write, do you like go in with things like that on your mind, or do you kind of just go in and write and whatever comes, comes, and you turn it into something?
I think it's a bit of both, but it seems to fall on the instinctual level. Yeah. For this album, I had no concept going in. I mean, the album had been in the works for 12 years. So some of the songs started writing in 2005. Mm.
So you're always writing.
Yeah, for better or worse.
And I mean, how do you write? Do you write on piano still?
Yeah, on piano, 90% of the time, 93%.
How did the record kind of come together as far as, obviously it's about to come out. I mean, how did you pick what would fit and work kind of the more spoken word type stuff in?
Well, as far as the song choices, that was rather happenstance as they went. I'd work on one for a long time and think, this one's just not that good, and set it aside. And then I would go back and think, you know what, it is good. And maybe I'll finally finish that song I've been working on for 10 years, and now it will finally come together. And it did. I found that great lyric, and I can't believe it took me 10 years to have that lyric plop in. I would like to think it was from this wrestling, and I just worked and worked, but it would just happen really quick. And then you feel so stupid that why couldn't I have done that 10 years ago? It took no effort at all. But that's it's a strange, I mean, this is said time and time again, that it seems like it's just one day, it's just all there. One day I could write 6 songs so fast, I could barely keep up to record the ideas.
Right.
I would stop recording one because a new idea would come and I would get it. But it's not as though I thought up this idea. It's just there. So I feel like with the creative process so much, it seems, I've heard this echoed by countless people, I guess almost down through the ages, that it doesn't even seem that you can set the conditions to receive an idea. Cause I don't even think that is something I've been able to do reliably. You just, when it does happen, your obligation is to jump on it, to put down everything and to go.
Do you demo everything? Like if you have an idea, you run and demo it?
Well, I'll record something, even if it's just into a tape recorder or just even on the keyboard if it has a record function, just not to forget it. But even the best ideas, the best song ideas I've never recorded and just remembered.
Yeah.
Even for 10 years, just remember that melody. And that's how you can also tell it's good.
Yeah.
I do respectfully disagree in a touch where I want to bring up, because I feel like a lot of people I know who are artists, musicians, and that type, who solely go on the creative urge. Mm-hmm. Like, you had the background in music, and like you said, music was such an inherent part of you at that point that anytime that expression needed to come, music was the extension. And I feel like with any instrument, I always tell people who are like younger musicians who are like waiting for this like eureka moment. I'm like, they will come. And like, you're right, they come in unpredictable times and you don't know. But you can set the conditions for yourself by being adequate at your instrument.
Oh, that's for sure.
And by like
practicing.
And by like the thing going into your head. You know, the weeks of practice and crappy stuff you do prior to that by forcing yourself to play actually allows you to execute what comes into your head.
Hey, I can't, I'd like to disagree with it, but I can't, because for one whole month I spent in a formal recording studio at great expense with a lot of other people involved and barely got anything done and was completely upset about it, quite dismayed. And then went out of that, and 2 weeks later recorded everything. So, and my manager even said, he said, you know, this is exactly what I thought was going to happen. You're going to go in, you're going to get very frustrated, and then you're going to come out, and then you're going to record like the greatest stuff. Like you had to go in, you had to have a bad time.
I don't know your manager, but that's a great.
He wouldn't appreciate that.
I can actually even sort of visualize like the outfit, everything going on. It's really
He's
good.
Out there, so you can see. That was a bit of an that's my exaggerated caricature of him.
You play everything on the record, right?
I did, and then I brought in my excellent guitar player, Dave Pino, to add another layer of guitar because nice. His tone, I write these parts and I like what I'm able to do on guitar for this music, but I'm not a traditional guitar player. So especially his tone, he just gets this tone that I don't have.
The guitars are...
Well, thanks.
They're nice on that, right?
Yeah, for sure. It's a lot of stuff nice and stacked thick. Up, but it's certainly a lot of Dave Pino. Yeah. Very, very capable, and I'm very thankful to have him in my band. I agree with what you're saying. All I can say is that the best stuff I've written mm-hmm. for me is essentially sitting down and just closing my eyes and saying, if I could imagine the greatest song that's never been written, what would it sound like? And then trying to make that.
Yeah.
You know, hear it. Okay, it would start like this, and then it would go like this, and then there'd be this part like this.
Right.
And sometimes it might not pan out, and you start realizing, it's not that good. Or you tweak it a bit, you move the chords around, and sometimes it can happen from jamming and just sitting down at the piano and playing.
Sure.
And I have talked to people who I respect a great deal who work rigorously and force themselves to record 10 hours a day, whether they get anything usable or not.
Mm-hmm.
And part of me admires that and thinks, gosh, I wish I could do that. And part of me wants to vomit when sure. I think of that idea. But I also can say, as you said, and this is true, and I kind of forget that it's true, but I've practiced piano for, you know, probably thousands of hours at this point after all these years, 34 years. And that does add up to some condition in itself being set.
Yeah.
So time spent does seem to be important one way or another.
Do you set time aside kind of every day to write? Because I feel like, are you kind of regimented as far as that goes?
No, I'll think of stuff. And then I'll write it down. But it's not, that will just happen when I'm driving somewhere or in the airport or something like that. But I do practice piano as much as I can just for the sake of practicing it. So working on some piece that someone else wrote, trying to learn it. And
do you practice mainly classical stuff?
Yeah. Yeah. Just for the challenge of it. And going back to what you asked about the frustrations of the business and
sure.
and maybe not even so much the business, but this career as music as a profession. Recently, through these efforts to just practice piano for no particular reason, it showed me and reminded me that no matter whatever happened, I could always go, not back, but that relationship with the instrument that I had from the very beginning is still there. And no one can take that from me unless a hand's got chopped off or something.
I mean, and that being said, you know, I wonder, like, you know, in that context, you know, music seems to be, it's such a part of you, but I wonder, like, the message is so important to you. It's so important to not only relay the message, but relay it in a very particular way. And I wonder if, like, for some reason through the years, like, music stopped connecting with people. Do you think you would find, like, a different vessel to try to get that message out? If, like, the Andrew WK, like, musical model, like, just wasn't connecting or working anymore, like, would you find another way? Or attempt to find another way to spread what you're trying to spread, kind of.
I've thought about that recently in a kind of horrifying way, because I never would even allow myself to entertain the thought of not being able to do this.
Right.
And I still can't fully imagine a circumstance so dire that I'd have to completely shut everything down. But it is possible. And it's good to be, I suppose, aware of that, at least just even for the humility that's involved in facing that possibility.
Sure.
Anything that, I guess going back to that, as cliched as it might sound, adds more light, any sort of service, seems like it would be of a similar value.
Hmm.
Maybe even more valuable for, you know, to be used by the party gods to bring more party to the planet. That's what I want to do. And if this seems like the most efficient and the best use of my skills so far, but if they'll tell me what to do, if they want to shut this down, they'll shut it down and they'll send me on some other task. And I'll do the best I can to not let my ego stand in the way of that and not be too crushed.
When you speak to them, do they speak to you or do you summon the party gods?
It's all part of that instinctual. You know, I suppose it's like a vision, you know, but usually when I thought of, again, sort of like dreams, like you dream up your dream and I have a vision, but it's not my vision. It's like the vision is shown to you. I think going back to what we were talking about that type of revelation,
right.
You are presented with something. And then the only part that's up to you is, can you carry this out?
Mm. I mean, how does your definition sort of partying kind of figure into things? Because I was talking about you with someone earlier today who wasn't familiar with your music. I was like, oh, it's about partying. She was like, oh, it's just like about getting messed up. And I was like, no, it's much more nuanced. And she was like, well, how? And I was like, I can't really explain it, but trust me, it's very nuanced.
The whole part of the trick is how could partying be nuanced? And that's the thing, is it kind of isn't. I mean, the concept is a non-concept in a sense. It's meant to be as as bluntly simple as it could be. And then this idea, oh, well, and I appreciate you saying, oh, there's more to it than that, because I'd like to think there's more to it, of course, even if it's just that there's songs and there's some writing and there's things to explore. There kind of isn't more to it than that. It's trying to celebrate existence. I mean, that's it.
I guess so many people, associate partying with, like, binge drinking.
Intoxication.
Yes.
Chemical intoxication. Well, you can get intoxicated on music, and you can get intoxicated on all different intensities of life. And I wouldn't write off any of those. I think, what's the quote? The road of excess leads to the palace of wisdom. So you want to live life to the fullest, to the sense that you're equipped to do so. Mm. And past that level of full, where it overflows, is where damage can be done that actually takes away some of the life force.
Right.
So you're trying to keep it filled all the way to the top and push yourself. But I think it is as simple as having a party about life. That's the mindset I wanted to think. So and that it's meant to be baffling in a sense too, because someone the quick things that you and I would question is, well, what is this count as partying? Is something horrible? You know, is all this the evil? The classic question. Well, if God exists, how could there be evil? It's like, exactly. It's pretty baffling that it is, but it does.
Yeah,
and that's for us. That's not his fault. That's for us not understanding it. So it all counts as partying, and that's why it's challenging.
Yeah, and I feel like these simple concepts always kind of lend themselves to overanalyzing, too. Like you always
It can be fun to do that, though.
Yeah.
I enjoy it. Unless it starts, if it starts to wear you down, then you can just go back to just party hard and keep it as one-dimensional as you want. I always wanted it to be very one-dimensional, and then you could go inside that dimension, and it would be limitless in dimension.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's like the deliverer in your case. It's like the concept is simple, but once people get to know you and what you're trying to say and you understand that it just comes from a different place, so it makes you think a little. I wonder about your T-shirts, I'm a big white T-shirt wearer.
Okay.
Most of my life, got a Crispy on right now.
Oh, wow. Here. There you go.
But the interesting thing to me is like, I really enjoy like a crispy white.
Crisp.
Like straight out the pack.
Oh.
When it's like in the summer and I got a nice tan, like the white on the tan skin.
You don't even wash it out. You would wear it straight out.
I don't
out.
Even wash out
oh,
of the
wow.
pack.
That's
I don't care
factory
where it
sizing.
Comes from. That new crease.
Right.
Don't even mind.
That smell.
And
that
like,
chemical smell.
And I feel like by the time shirts get to like where you rock them, I start turning them into like rags. So like
dressed in rags.
So I need to know how it got from like packaging to this. Like, is it a washing process or just wearing process? And do you wear the crispy whites out of the house, or do you have to like wear them in the house for a while to like get them worn in?
It would only be the most extreme circumstances let's say I got to a place and somehow I didn't have my dirty whites.
Yeah.
But someone had just bought a brand new pack of T-shirts, and that's all there was. Of course, I'd wear that over a black shirt or a red shirt or any other shirt that might be there. But if I have my druthers, I want it to be well worn in. I want it to be partied in. And it does take some party, but not as much as you might expect.
No,
I'm
white shirts
amazed.
They go quick.
They go real quick.
Yeah.
And since I'm not looking to keep them clean, since that's not high on the priority list, they go even faster.
Sure.
So I could get one to this state that it's in right now, probably in two shows.
Yeah,
maybe even one.
But do you feel like embarrassed when the fresh one is on? Like you just can't wait to get it filthy?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't fit quite right. It's almost sort of like denim or leather, I feel.
I feel like the fit is
once
huge.
You sweat, it takes the shape of your body.
I'm shocked no one's approached you yet. Like a Fruit of the Loom. Wait, do you have a brand?
I do. And
yeah,
it is
you
Fruit
must.
Of the Loom.
It's Fruits.
It is.
Because I'm surprised they haven't like offered like a distressed Andrew W.K. line.
I'm
or,
not,
you know,
in their mind, the best representative of their product.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, I think you're right. And I would love to represent.
But giant
I do wear
six
their
foot,
product.
Dude, are you kidding me?
Giant 6 foot thing of grapes. Is better.
You know what?
Well,
everyone likes.
I think terrifying.
Those guys are very appealing in their own sense.
They
I
are,
don't want to disrespect them. I would love to represent them in a formal capacity to be a spokesman for Fruit of the Loom.
Yeah.
But I don't blame them for not wanting to be associated with me. Because for me, it's a win. For them, it's a big risk.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, they'd really be stepping out their comfort zone.
Yeah. But I found these to be the best fit, the best consistency. But they're always changing them, too. They always got to revamp to keep their brand interesting. But they've been the lesser of between Hanes and what's the other one, Jockey.
Jockeys.
They really are into, now we did this, now we did that, now the collar's thicker, now the shirt's longer. So this
the
one
Hanes
is still,
feel like stiff to me.
You know, Hanes did something to their necks.
Their
they
neck
like thickened
weird.
Up the neck.
Yeah. And I think that's like great because it's supposed to lie flat.
Exactly.
Yeah,
don't like
that.
Yeah.
You got to reinvent the wheel. That's.
I'm embarrassed to say that I've gone a little bougie of late and I started wearing polos.
Oh, wow. Ooh.
They're nice, though. They're nice.
That might be out of my league.
Moving on up.
Honestly, they're too expensive for white shirts.
But that's how you can tell
it's good. But this is how much crispy whites mean to me. And I have a very oddly shaped body.
Odd body.
No, you don't.
I do.
Like a pea body?
Oh,
is it shaped like a pea?
Don't make me get into this. More of an eggplant. but like, if I were to show you guys like where pants would actually sit on my body if they went on my hips, I mean, would you like me to show you?
High hip, you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, I'll show you.
Let's see.
I mean, you can't see. But this is like, I'm sagging like crazy.
Yeah,
this is my hip.
I never would have known. Oh, wow.
So this is actually where, like, my pants should sit.
Wow. So you have very long legs.
And no,
yeah.
And
since
this is
a podcast, they're very high.
This is my pants.
Benny has two ribs.
Where's your belly button? Where's your belly button right now? Is it under the belt?
Right there.
Oh, wow.
And this is my rib.
Your rib is only 2 inches above your belly button. I don't think I've ever seen that.
Yeah.
That's not odd at all.
I mean, that's your rib.
I feel
okay.
like we're gonna have to release this as the press shot. Right?
Well, I gotta say, I think for a man or a woman, this balance, this what's the right word?
This feng shui of my
yeah,
body.
Yeah, to have long legs because now you look a lot taller when you did
oh,
that.
Yeah?
That's true.
Yeah.
Should I do that?
I think it was flattering.
Yeah.
Really?
I think it worked well.
Do you think that helps with drumming?
What, long legs?
Yeah.
No, I think it hurts.
Really?
Yeah, I think drumming is a short man's game, actually.
But you've
noticed a lot of good
too.
Short drummers.
Yeah.
So you can play far away from the kid. Do you play far away from the kid?
Well, you shouldn't. I mean, that's where you rotate cuffs, like
it's
all sorts of things.
Yeah.
I'm glad we talked about drums, though, because I stumbled upon your 24-hour drum marathon.
Okay.
And, I mean, was this your idea?
No, this was MTV Viacom's idea. It was a Viacom O Music Awards.
Okay.
Which was, I guess, CMT, and it was all the Viacom TV. So MTV, MTV2, maybe CMT. But they did these, in addition to the awards, they did these events or sort of stunts around them, and they had the idea to have somebody drum for 24 hours. And I volunteered for that.
Yeah.
I guess they approached me. And I think because I wasn't really a drummer,
right,
I didn't think through how what would really be involved.
Right.
I've drummed,
sure,
but out of respect for even the drummers that I play with in my own band, I would never call myself a drummer. Just so you'd never call myself a guitar player. I'm proficient in keyboard. That's it. Piano.
I watched the video of the last 5 minutes, and
who was with me? Was it just me alone, or was it
just you? Just you and some sick drum gloves.
Yeah. And the funniest thing is I thought my hands and my arms were just going to be destroyed.
Yeah.
It was from sitting down
for
24 hours. It was the most brutal.
Your back.
Sure.
My back and the creases from the fabric, like bed sores, essentially.
Yeah.
I had drum sores, but not hand. My hands were totally fine.
Were your hands numb?
No, not really. My back hurt. That was probably the biggest backache. And as soon as we were done, I was fine. I mean, I was tired.
Yeah.
But I was joined by many great drummers who played duets with me.
Questlove jumped on, I saw.
Oh, yeah, Questlove, Chad Smith. That was one of the cool. most, that was towards the end.
That's
and
cool.
he really
so
gave
cool,
me this yeah. boost of, it was a powerhouse drummer.
Nice. Yeah.
Mikey Ramone came by.
Cool. That's amazing.
Zach from Hanson came by. Liberty DeVito
wow.
came
oh,
by,
awesome.
amongst many others that I apologize for
that's
not
an
being
all-star,
a little
local all-star shout-out. Drummer
that
cast.
Kept me going.
yeah.
As that's did awesome. The folks watching in Times Square. We were at the Oakley store.
Yeah.
And they would watch through the glass. That all helped. So it wasn't as hard as I thought it would be, and then it was much harder in other ways.
Yeah, all my friends who I mentioned you were coming on were so excited about your connection with Obituary. They're like, he played with the guy from Obituary. And they were,
yes,
everyone was
Donald
like,
Tardy, an yeah. amazing, amazing, amazing drummer.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
He was my first drummer
oh,
in
really?
My band. Yeah,
I didn't know that.
It's a very strange story.
Wow, yeah. How did
Another
that come
Destiny
to pass?
Story. Where a guy that eventually became my manager had grown up in Florida, and we were talking, this was early on, so I was probably 19 or 20, we were talking about Obituary, this was in New York, and he mentioned that he had grown up in that town, he was friends with Obituary, I just couldn't believe that. So Obituary at that point, and to this day, was there was no band I liked more, and spent so much time listening to it, I just really clicked with their music. And I'll say I like metal and I like death metal, but there's very few bands that I have spent that much time with in that genre, or really any genre.
Sure.
And I liked the singing especially, and I liked the drumming especially. I liked it all, but I was just blown away by the Tardy brothers. John Tardy, who sings, no
right.
one sounds like that. And Donald Tardy, who drums, who has this particular approach. It's very musical and tight and tasty, as they mm-hmm. would say. And when I found out this guy had their home address, I wrote a letter to Donald Tardy and asked him to be in my band, which was the most absurd thing that you would ever do. And I guess it was, again, I just turned off my rational mind that would have
yeah.
told me, why would you even bother? You're just going to make a fool. He won't even open the envelope. It's just, and 2 weeks later, maybe not even, maybe a week later, I got home from work and there was a message on the answering machine that said, yo, man, this is DT. I got your demo. It's cool. I'm up for it. Let's do it.
Whoa.
And at that time, the Obituary had sort of been on a hiatus.
Yeah, yeah.
And next thing I knew, Donald Tardy was the drummer in my band,
no shit.
Recording on that first album, and then essentially assembled my entire live band and crew. Some of the guys I still play with now, and
wow.
have become my best friends.
How cool!
Wow.
And if that is an example of an outlandish dream coming true, because that's the thing, I didn't do anything to make that happen. I mean, I took that small bit of action.
I mean, it's a real bit of action.
Just putting yourself out.
Most people stop themselves from writing that letter, you know?
But it's what you're saying, like turning off the rational mind, turning off that part that says like, nah,
right.
what's
right.
the point?
Yeah, this guy will never get back to me. You're like, fuck it, I'll send it.
Yeah,
But like there was that. Other powers at work.
Sure.
Because there were so many other things that, like, he himself wanting to do it that had to come
into alignment.
Like,
yeah.
And these other kinds of synchronicities. And maybe it's just interesting to me more than to the outside observer, but I'm very amazed by it because I think of how many other ways things could have gone and how many other people could have been the first drummer that could have formed a different band. And I guess I'm very thankful.
That's like the butterfly effect thing. Like,
very thankful for the butterflies that brought Donald Tardy into my world.
I need your advice.
Okay.
Now,
try my best.
I used to read your advice column.
Oh, thank you.
That which was very cool.
Thank you very
and
much.
And that's actually, I think, when I was like, when I discovered, I'm like, oh shit, Andrew W.K.'s deep. And, you
well,
know.
That's kind of you to say.
So I heard in an interview you were talking about you had like a bit of a road rage incident. Mm. I mean, it was in that Glenn Beck interview. And you were talking about an incident where you like got mad on the roads and you had to like, you know, calling someone an asshole and just hot on him, but then had to reel yourself back. Recently, this has been a trigger of mine.
Mm.
And I feel like I'm pretty close to like maybe like murdering someone in the wrong context.
Because you live in New Jersey, man.
Where you get mad at them or they get mad at you? Or
me,
both?
It's like me getting mad, but way madder than I should because it's not just the thing that happens. It's like it represents some like great injustice and disrespect that I'm taking and internalizing very personally right now. Now, I understand when you can step back and you realize all people have problems and, you know, they're unique and you can't understand anyone else's situation. You know, once I relax, I can think like that.
Mm-hmm.
What would be a useful tool in that moment to reel myself back?
There's there's I've used all kinds of tricks for this exact thing. So I have some latest ones because they actually happened.
Okay.
An old one that I used to use was, oh, what if I ended up knowing this person? Well, that actually happened where this woman pulled out in front of me and I almost hit her and was just driving. She wasn't even driving badly, but in the mood I was in, it offended me and it was not the right thing to do. And I was almost going to give her a dirty look or just kind of in feeling that way. And then I looked and it was my mother-in-law.
Wow.
Oh, okay. And that was a real example of that. So sometimes I think, oh, what if this is someone that I know, or if they found out that I was mad at them while driving, it would have a negative impact on their life or mine.
Okay.
I guess an easier version that's very similar to that is I think, oh, that person's going to the hospital because someone's dying or they're about to have a baby or there's some emergency they're in.
Sure.
That only applies if they're speeding or driving, especially aggressively.
But giving a little benefit of the doubt there.
Benefit of the doubt, because I've been in that situation myself sometimes.
Same.
So that helps. And beyond that, I think that that whole idea of thinking of it as a test, but it does take, what you're trying to do is shorten the distance between having that intense emotional reaction and then remembering all these options of other ways to look at
it.
And you're trying to keep those other ways that you look at it for in front of that emotional reaction
as the
first point of perspective.
Right.
But that is challenging, and that takes I think it just takes practice. I think kind of embarrassing yourself through shame of how low that behavior is and how despicable it is and how you don't want to be that is quite helpful. Like imagining a camera on you.
Or like
you
one, watching like yourself. Your friends seeing you being that guy.
Yeah, not being your best self. That kind of thing. Or your mom or anyone you respected that you wouldn't want them to see. And realize that's also you, and you're kind of like your guardian angel. The best version of you is it's like, come on, don't do this. Don't don't let me see you be like this. And to try through that kind of humility to say, I'm not in charge of the world. I'm not in charge of these other drivers. I don't. If they inconvenience me, that's not some injustice.
Right.
That's up to something bigger and far beyond me. And I'm just lucky to be here at all. And I should just try to cause as little problems as possible. And this is not all set up for me and my convenience for me to get where I want to go without any problems or without any missteps.
It feels like it. It's so crazy.
It's a real specific thing in driving because the way we feel and behave in driving doesn't seem to happen in any other situation.
Well, you feel really safe once you close yourself in your car.
But it's
true. You know, I heard, forget which comic, but the comic talked about how what other context do you see someone who lightly offends you and you're only a foot or two away from them and you'll be like, you fucking cocksucker.
It's got to be like Bill Burr.
If someone brushed by you in like an elevator.
Or in the grocery store line.
Or a grocery store and they were just down the aisle and you're like, you fucking cocksucker.
Or you just give them the finger.
Fuck you, asshole. And you're like, whoa, I dropped an orange. Like
it brings out the worst.
Yeah. I had a couple of things happen. Like one time it was me and my wife in the car, and it got to the point where I got out of the car.
Oh, no.
Which is, like,
bad.
Really far.
That's
like, I'm not that guy. I'm
that's
pretty
stepping
mellow.
It up, yeah.
Out of the cocoon. Just,
and, gotta be careful where you get out of the
did
car.
Did you have a plan?
No.
I was heat of the moment.
Like, it was just something. I forget exactly what happened, and I stopped myself, and I was like, what am I fucking doing? And I got back in the car, and then within, like, a week, there was a story about a road rage incident and someone got killed.
Yeah.
And I was like, I could have been that fucking guy.
Andrew, do you practice any sort of breathing exercises or meditation or mindfulness-type stuff, or is that sort of just the music kind of does that for you?
I mean, exercising, practicing piano, it takes a kind of concentration that's quite unique. Can't really think about much else. In a way I enjoy performing is that state, anything that takes like full blown effort. And then I guess the extreme flip opposite side of meditation, I have tried it over the years. There was a period when I was doing it very consistently, but it was so physically draining. I was just dripping with sweat. And I thought this can't be how this is supposed to go. Soaking wet from sitting still.
Huh. Really?
It was the hardest thing I'd ever done. Kind of like that drumming thing. Just so brutal.
Have you ever seen that, Jonah?
No, experience? No, never heard of that.
And I wasn't sitting in a crazy posture. I would sit like this. And after 45 minutes, just drenched.
Wow.
And shaking from the effort to, I'm not trying to like sit like a concrete statue, but sit still, and it hurts.
Yeah.
And you're not supposed to move once it starts hurting, and you're supposed to go past that. This was the school that I was in, or what it was described to me, which I don't even know what school it is. But I've actually quite recently looked at it again and thought, you know what? I understand what this is supposed to feel like. It's supposed to feel like, I think, and I'm being presumptuous, like that perfect, beautiful clarity you get right before you fall asleep and then you wake back out of it, or right as you're waking up from sleep before you've fully inhabited your conscious mind again. It's this in-between space of pure clarity.
Yeah.
It's quite intense because you see everything for what it is without any of the judgments and pre-made decisions that overlap and cloud that clarity. So you see life is very short and it's all falling away, and but it's kind of beautiful and it's bittersweet. And I think maybe that's what people end up getting to with meditation, is they go into that and then they stay there for the half hour and not just 5 seconds as you wake out of a sort of in-between sleep. If you ever go to bed when it's bedtime or when other people are going to bed, but you sort of have the plan not to go to sleep, so you're just laying down, that's when I've been able to do it and gotten these few little brief moments. But it's quite heavy.
Yeah.
And sometimes if you watch a TV show that's very emotional or a movie that's very emotional and you come out of that, there's this period where there's this lingering echo of feeling. And I can only say it as clarity again. The kind of feeling where it makes you want to reach out to all the people that you might think you've ever wronged and do everything you possibly can to live a good life. And I don't know what that means, but it has to be good. It has to be coming from a good place.
Do you ever come to that feeling when you're playing, whether it's practicing or performing, playing music?
It takes so much concentration for me that and physical effort that it's hard to
lose yourself like that.
Yeah, I admire people that do that, and I kind of imagine what it would be like. I notice it, and then the minute you notice it, then you're out of
exactly.
it again.
Right. Yeah.
I think, oh, I'm playing really well, and then it will.
You become conscious.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'm sure with practice, that's part of the practice. I was thinking about that. These world class concert pianists, the pressure.
Oh my God.
That they have to go to be a solo pianist.
Yeah. Well, absolute perfection.
And they look like it's effortless.
Yeah. The pressure, like a golfer or something, or a chess player with it, this very quiet, tense environment where just going into a place like Carnegie Hall, if there's nothing going on, has this, there's this palpable atmosphere.
There's got to be like...
I'm getting anxiety just thinking about it.
I know people don't think about it in that context, but I remember reading a quote from Robert Plant that said, like, in order to be what I am, like, on stage, I have to have the biggest ego in the room. Like, I have to feel like I'm above all of this. And, like, I know it's, like, hard to imagine with someone with, like, a bow tie and coattails, but I bet some of these people are, like, gangster about what they do. They're like, you know what, motherfucker? I'm like top 5 piano player in the world. You guys are coming to see me. I'm getting paid. Like, I bet they're like more gangster than you
there's
think.
There's a lot of that.
You know?
I think that goes into
yeah.
it. It's
yeah.
It's got to be.
Confidence one way or another.
Yeah.
Whether it's psyching themselves up like a fighter or a boxer would.
Yeah.
Or if it's genuine confidence that came from 80 years
right.
of practicing 6 hours a day.
Yeah.
Eventually, you would just get so good that you really could be that good
and
be
you're
confident.
Like, you're Kobe Bryant, you know?
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
just that.
But they still, but that discounts the real effort that it still takes and the real risks that they're taking. That's obviously part of the thrill of going to watch someone be in that state of consummate skill, but also the tightrope walk.
Right.
I always feel like concert halls like that, and I'm not a religious person, but they give me the same feeling as going to church when I was a kid.
As a kid especially.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it was one of those event kind of spaces.
It's just like a weird atmosphere.
What do you think about the coughing? You ever notice that? There's always coughing.
Always coughing. And you can't tell where it comes from.
I would just think, why would you just... And then I've been the person that went and had this really bad, irrepressible cough. And you can't leave either because that makes noise to go out the door.
That's even worse, yeah.
Man.
And you hear it on the recordings.
I feel like they sell cough drops, like Ludens and stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, well, they do. In the fancy bathrooms, they'll give you cough drops.
I think so.
What's the deal with that?
I did a sound bath recently and had to cough. And it was, I didn't even want to swallow. I was like, swallowing is going to be too loud. It totally sounds like everyone's lying down.
Yeah. Talk about pressure.
Yeah, sound baths are a lot of pressure.
Wait. You know,
blood judgment going on.
I don't know what you're talking about.
A sound bath is silent?
Well, this was like the beginning. It was like kind of a meditative thing at the beginning.
Yeah, I know. Jonah's into some shit.
And then they started playing all these kind of ancient instruments and bowls.
Yeah, Tibetan singing bowls.
Yeah, I love exactly.
And someone would go... it would be deafeningly loud, right?
I thought I was so good. And then the person I went with, she was like, you were snoring. And I was like, no way.
Dude, I feel like I would be that guy.
I was horrified.
I feel like I would be that guy, like breathing loud.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The whistle or something.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. My right nostril's 95% blocked. So I'm fucking that place.
Yeah,
I need an oxygen mask.
I don't
feel too well.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming by.
Wait, one last one.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, no.
This is extremely pressing to me.
Okay.
Because it's such an important part
of
what you do. No, the advice I found.
About the car. Good. Okay.
I need to know your BPM.
Oh, my chosen BPM?
Your bangs per minute.
Oh, headbangs?
Yeah. Do you know? Have you ever timed?
Well, if I headbang on a song like Party Hard, which is, I think, when we play it live, probably 165, 168 or something.
Yeah, quick.
That's fast.
But I do it on, you know, ding. I do it every other beat. Mm-hmm. Well, on I Get Wet or something, I would do it on every beat. So, yeah, I guess somewhere between 160 and 170.
That's strong.
We had one song called Headbang that was on an EP, so it's a bit more rare. But we played live for a good period, the last song of the first portion of our set. For me, it was the last song of the second portion of our set, but it has a very fast, not like grindcore fast, but and I was able to do that, but that was not pleasant.
Yeah,
headbanging at that speed.
Do you get rock neck? You get a little
sore
neck?
Well, of course, after the first few days, if you haven't done it in a while,
sure.
I think my neck is, I've figured out the way that I can do it. Although it's very hard to do it without being in the midst of the music and the performance.
Yes.
It's hard to do kind of on command. But I've never been able to do the swirl, the windmill here.
Yeah.
I've never been able to do that. And I have my version of the headband that works for me.
Gotcha.
Yeah, everyone's got to find their own, I guess.
Yeah, I think
yeah.
so.
It's very specific.
I have one last question, kind of related to the album. I watched the little mini doc about the artwork.
Yes.
Which was,
yeah, super
I thought,
cool.
So
that art
cool.
is great. Yeah.
Thank
I
you.
Love
yeah.
it. Do you paint at all or draw?
I do, but very infrequently. Sort of maybe like we were talking about, where it's something I had done for so long out of the joy of doing it and for the need to do it, or just something that was part of life. But there was a time when, I was going to go to art school and wanted to be a painter and work in fine arts. And then I got much more interested in how that same skill set or some of those same disciplines or those same approaches could be applied to what I thought was a bigger canvas, like entertainment.
Because
in entertainment, it all counts.
Right.
If you want to make films, you can make videos. If you want to make clothes, you can make your stage clothes. You know, in my case, I'm not really doing that, but of course, you can do paintings for your album cover. You can make up songs. So there was this amazing, like, everything counted in this business. That's what I liked. It wasn't just hanging a painting up on a wall. It had utility. It could be an album cover. It could be a t-shirt design. It could be a sticker. It represented something.
Right.
So now, in order for me to paint, it has to be for something. So the last painting I did was this taco eyeball guitar, custom guitar that
That's
I have.
That's awesome.
And that was really fun, and it made me think, I should paint more.
I think I saw you have a pizza guitar.
I did the pizza guitar, too, yeah.
That's cool.
But it's also not sort of in the same areas like drums and guitar. It's not one of my strongest things. So I'm trying to think to pick what I think I have the best shot at getting the best at and letting the other things remain on the fringes and use them when necessary. I really want to just get better at piano because I feel that's the only thing I have the chance to actually get pretty good at. And by pretty good, meaning better than I am now.
All right. right. Thank you to Andrew W.K.
Yeah, good
thank
job.
You.
Yeah. Man, I wish I could have been here. For
thank you for coming by his new album. You're Not Alone. Comes out on March 2nd on a little label called Sony Music. Maybe you've heard of it.
Just a little, you know, a little workshop.
Workshop.
Little workshop.
Yeah, they may have made your TV.
You were just talking about DIY.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is true.
We got to get him on again, too, because the one thing I'm curious about now that we missed it is, like, I feel like he's like Samson, where if you cut his hair, like, his muscles would, like, would go down.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I feel like there's something there.
He's pretty buff.
Bigger than I thought.
Yeah.
I certainly wouldn't talk out of turn to him.
I posted that photo. Steven took this photo of me in between him and Benny, and I felt like a little kid. Like, I look tiny.
You look really small.
I love it. No. Yeah.
And I'm not that small. I'm like a regular size
What is your
person.
Height? Are you an average height man?
I think I'm, you know, I'm like 5'10".
That's average.
Yeah, that's average. Totally...
I mean, well, you can safely know that Andrew W.K. and I are closer to gigantism than you are to dwarfism.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
So yes. Sleep well knowing that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
You guys could play in the NBA, maybe.
No. 6'4" in the NBA means you have to be wildly athletic.
Really?
Which, there's a reason I do what I do, Jonah.
Yeah.
It's not my athleticism.
I got it. Well, there's a reason we're recording at Pulse Music.
Pulse Music.
Pulse Music. It sounds amazing.
If you like the way this sounds, book a session at Pulse Music. They've been very generous to let us use their studio. Book a session with Stephen Grywalski. Tell him that we sent you, and your audio project will sound just as good as this podcast.
Yeah, it's a great place. And you know what it came equipped with today?
What's that?
Not only a pot of coffee with a mug that says coffee makes you poop, but Girl Scout cookies.
Yes.
Steven, can you tell us if at Pulse, does this come with part of the recording package?
It could.
Okay.
For the right price.
So... It's in the cards. Jonah, do you have all of our backslash things ready to go?
Yes, I was trying to think of a Girl Scouts cookie studio pun. And I was like, thin minimizer or something. I was getting... if you want to support this podcast, go to Pulse. After that, you can go to patreon.com/goingofftrack.
Yes.
And become a patron.
Yes.
Which we'd appreciate.
Which we appreciate greatly.
You can see a lot of goofy outtakes, and we have bonus episodes that you can listen to.
And I'd say the bonus episodes are really where we cut loose.
Yeah, we cut loose.
When there's guests here, I feel like I have to behave.
You're buttoned up.
Yeah, I'm buttoned up. And when we're just kicking it on the bonus
there
episodes.
There's some dirty bonus episodes.
I'm pretty
I'll say that.
I feel open.
If any of you guys want to hear what doesn't make the cut.
I do.
There's definitely some things.
I forget almost sometimes that
you gotta pay
other humans are going to hear.
It's sort of like, you know, like that Jerry Springer, like too hot for TV.
Yes. Yes.
What's the guy? Steve?
Steve,
another,
yeah.
Steve.
It's like
Steve. Do you think people would throw us an extra couple shekels if we did these shirtless?
Maybe.
I don't know. Live stream.
I am going to post more video, though.
More
too.
Video.
But you can only see it if you're a patron.
Yeah, so Jonah's wearing that Holden Caulfield hat again. So you should.
But some people
see
prefer
this.
To pay as they go, and you can shoot us some cash on Venmo. Venmo.com/offtrack.
Or you can leave us a nice review on iTunes if you don't have money, because that makes us look legit.
We have some amazing people. You know who you are, Ren.
Ren Volpe.
He's a patron. And then every now and then he's like, oh, I love that episode. And he gives us money on.
Yeah, you guys could all take some notes from Ren.
Yeah. What up, Ren?
You know?
What up, though?
Yeah.
What up, though?
Thanks to Andrew WK for coming by. Thanks for listening. And we'll be back with the podcast next week.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hello, everyone. I'm Danny Pellegrino.
I'm Jenna Brister.
And we are back for season 4 of a very,
very, very iconic podcast.
where the two of us recap all the holiday movies we love and some that we don't love so much.
Yes, thank you so much for tuning in. Tis the season.
That's right. We're covering some classics this year. We are recapping the entire Santa Claus trilogy. We're going to be diving into a Halloween movie this year.
Yes, Hocus Pocus 2.
That's right, the sequel. We also have I'll Be Home for Christmas starring Jonathan Taylor Thomas. So we are leaning into the home improvement of it all. And if you want to follow along, you can go to Instagram. It's at A Very Merry Iconic Podcast on Instagram. And be sure to listen, subscribe, tell a friend.
Have a very merry iconic day.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.